Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 23rd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Ahead on this Monday edition of Ozarks, we travel to Mutasia by visiting with the author of the series for young readers. Plus, gifts for children that encourage a love for insects and nature. Becca Martin Brown tells us where to catch Santa in the next 2 days before Christmas. And a Talk Business Arkansas update. But first, Dr. Ellen Lead Feldner is the director of the Arkansas Interdisciplinary Sciences Laboratory, or ARKIDS, at the University of Arkansas. ARKIDS focuses on understanding what puts kids at risk for anxiety and drug use during adolescence. They're currently focusing on parenting and family factors' effects on those. Parenting in adolescence can be difficult for both parents and kids. And as a parent, if you're dealing with a mental illness or post-traumatic stress disorder, it can be much more difficult. Dr. Liedfeldner is looking for families to participate in a research study to better understand these experiences, which could be heightened during this holiday season.
The holiday season can be very stressful for lots of reasons. And so we do know that when life is more stressful, it's difficult to appropriately and effectively parent, particularly, again, when you're dealing with an adolescent.
So do you focus a lot on post-traumatic stress syndrome, like a stress after a life event?
That's
a traumatic
right.
life event, I guess.
That's right. Right. So we're interested in how parents deal with extreme stress in general. But right, there are some kinds of events that are very, very stressful or traumatic, and they result in, you know, a set of symptoms that can be really difficult and distressing to live with, and certainly we think impacts that family system.
Even if a parent tries to maybe hide that stress from a child, it still probably trickles down.
It could. I mean, I think there's a lot we don't understand yet. I mean, so, for example, some parents don't even recognize that they have PTSD. And so they're sort of suffering and perhaps not even sure what's going on. One of the things about PTSD is that it just makes it difficult to manage events that are unexpected or distressing. And so, you're sort of tapped out in terms of your ability to manage stress. And so even if you're trying to hide it, it's likely to emerge, you know, and at a different point in a way, right, that might be discernible to kids.
I guess that's what you're trying to understand, is how it does affect kids. But how could it potentially?
Right. So, one piece is genetics, right, that anxiety disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorders, are partially heritable. And that doesn't mean that children are going to develop problems, but they're at a little bit elevated risk, right? And we're beginning to understand that perhaps their brain works a little bit differently. They may respond to stress in a different way than children of parents without PTSD, which, again, does not mean they're going to have problems. But if you add stress to that, for example, stress in the family context, that might be enough to sort of turn on some problems. So that's one piece. Another area that we're really focusing on is that the parenting process itself is likely disrupted, right? So again, if you think about parenting an adolescent, one has to be really mindful of which battles to pick and to be consistent and to set boundaries, but not too strict of boundaries. I mean, this is really a nuanced sort of dance. And so that's likely one way that PTSD impacts that relationship and add stress to that system.
Well, so if some parents, they don't even know that they are dealing with something, how can they come in and help you? How can they ask for help?
Right. Well, you know, the way that we are looking for participants is we're asking for parents who have experienced extreme stress, and then we can discern from there whether or not it rises to the level of PTSD. But it's also really important to know that we are looking for healthy parents, too, so that we can understand, you know, we can compare these families. And so it's not really, we need the community to sort of come out and help us and participate in this research so that we can answer all kinds of questions. So they don't just have to have PTSD or know that they have PTSD, for example.
So the ultimate goal is to provide a place where you can help right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. So what we need to do first is understand the nature of this disruption. So I've alluded to, we might think, okay, likely that parent-child relationship is going to have some problems, but there's just almost no data to suggest what that looks like. So for example, are parents with PTSD, are they more likely to be withdrawn? We don't know. And so we need to sort of start to examine those questions. But the long-term goal is to provide what we might call treatment adjunct. So you go in and you get, well, we have really good treatment for PTSD, and we can think about incorporating into those treatments family systems approaches. So here's some education about what you might expect, and here are some tools that you might be able to use to improve your relationship and understand how PTSD might be affecting it.
Too early to ask what some of those tools may be.
That's a good question. I don't think it's too early necessarily. I mean, it depends, again, on what these relationships look like. So, for example, if one of the things that parents are dealing with is feeling really angry, which is a common feature in PTSD, we could think about stress management. We could talk to them about cues in the environment that are maybe turning on that anger as a part of that PTSD syndrome, and how to manage that, right? So take a few minutes to yourself. Here are some conflict resolution strategies. But again, that may not be indicated if that's not what's going on, if you will. But I think once we can discern what the nature of the disruption is, then, right, we do have lots of ways that we can think about intervening.
Well, you look at how the parent is stressed and the parent is going through something. I mean, that's the focus of the study, but what if a child has experienced something? And surely that has an effect on their brothers and sisters and their parents.
Absolutely. That's a really good question. We refer to that as child-driven effects, right? So you're absolutely right that in this relationship, there are two or even more in the system, there are lots of people. And so ultimately, and in fact, we're doing some of this work right now in my lab, we need to understand what the child is bringing to the relationship. So for example, if you're a parent who's struggling with mental illness, you're having trouble dealing with stress, and your child is, you know, temperamentally easy, that's going to be a very different scenario than if your child is dealing, for example, with, you know, extreme anxiety or depression. And we're just beginning to sort of tap into those questions. But you're right. If we're going to have an intervention that's going to be effective, we need to consider all parties in the system.
What sorts of questions do you ask?
Well, we ask about their feelings and how they're doing. We can get a sense of symptoms. We ask about parenting and parenting approaches. The same with children. We look at how they manage their feelings. And again, at this stage of research development, we're trying to describe the problem, right, or the system. And so these questions are aimed at getting a sense of how is the system working and where are there some problems.
You mentioned earlier that there really isn't much data out there. Why is this something that hasn't really been studied before?
It's hard to study, right? I mean, and again, that is where we find ourselves. We need the help from the community to be able to answer this question. I mean, if you think about it, a parent who's dealing with significant stress, having to get to the lab and participate, that's a tall order, if you will. So they're hard to study. And I would say that there's enough descriptive research to know that these families are disrupted, right? I think we're just now moving into doing something about that.
Why is this something that you personally have chosen to devote your career to?
Right. Well, I'm really interested in anxiety. That's my bread and butter. And I think, honestly, the returning vets, the wars that we have all encountered, and the increasing understanding that PTSD can be extremely debilitating, and then wedding that with my interest in adolescence and the unique parenting challenges of that period, it was sort of an organic process that was influenced by those current events.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. The study takes about 4 hours at the ARKids lab. Parents are paid $20, adolescents $50, because their study is more in-depth. To sign up or for more information, visit www.familieswork.org or call 575-3523. Dr. Ellen Leed-Feldner is the director of the Arkansas Interdisciplinary Sciences Laboratory at the University of Arkansas.
the holidays, it's easy to lose sight of what it is we're celebrating.
One of the most important things I can do while I'm on this planet is honor those I love through celebrations.
I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales 2, stories that bring the holiday season into focus in a Christmas program from NPR.
Listen to Tinsel Tales Christmas Day from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on KUAF.
Arkansas CEOs are generally optimistic for the economy in the coming year, and new jobs head to both Baxter and Jefferson counties. Roby Brock has more in this Talk Business Arkansas update.
Talk Business, in conjunction with the State Chamber of Commerce and consulting group CEG Partners, released its first Business Leaders Confidence Survey, which asked 106 CEOs and company managers across Arkansas for their thoughts on the economy. Some key takeaways: 56% said revenues would increase slightly during the next 6 months, with another 8% saying revenues would increase significantly. Just 16% said revenues would stay the same, and a combined 20% expect revenues to decline. However, among the healthcare sector, just 24% expected increased revenues, with 64% saying finances in the healthcare sector would decrease slightly or significantly next year. 40% of business leaders in our survey expect significant or slight employee hiring. 35% see no change, while 24% expect a slight decline in headcount. 41% of those surveyed expect to increase slightly their capital expenditures in Arkansas, while 31% expect no change. Just 17% expected to decrease capital expenditure spending. Governor Mike Beebe and representatives of Hewlett-Packard announced 200 new jobs in Conway, less than 6 months after the technology giant laid off around 500 in Arkansas. The 200 jobs will largely involve software engineers, business analysts, and managers. Company officials said the jobs were related to HP's government and healthcare IT sectors across the U.S. Epoxen Products, a manufacturer of high-performance work surface solutions for research, educational, and healthcare laboratory environments, announced plans to expand its manufacturing facility in Mountain Home, creating 50 new jobs. Epoxen Products is part of Hamilton Scientific, a 132-year-old laboratory furniture and equipment supplier with corporate headquarters located in Wisconsin. Summit Poultry, an Arkansas corporation, has entered into an agreement to acquire the former Horizon Foods poultry processing facility in Pine Bluff. Summit actually took possession of the plant in early December. It will process spent hens, primarily for export markets around the world. According to company officials, Summit Poultry has already hired workers to fill 100 available positions at the plant. Most of the new hires formerly worked at the processing plant under previous management. During the regular legislative session earlier this year, state lawmakers and Governor Mike Beebe frequently discussed a connection between nearly $140 million in delayed tax cuts and approval of the state's private option, a health insurance plan for lower-income citizens. However, legislators said last week they view the tax cuts as permanent, regardless of what happens with the private option in the fiscal session in February. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large comes from AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. There are some odd characters inhabiting Mutasia. One animal, for example, is part cow, part possum. Another is a combination of a mosquito and a wasp. The creatures are included in stories that help young readers better understand their world. The second book in the Mutasia series is Clubhouse Clash and is written by Justin Minkle. Justin, an elementary school teacher in the Springdale School District, was named Arkansas's Teacher of the Year in 2007. He says his book about a misunderstanding that escalates into a full conflict was inspired, in part, by watching his students. He recently stopped by the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.
So the world and the characters were created by other people other than me, some really brilliant artists that kind of brought everything to life visually. And what I love about it is that it's basically this island where there are no adults. It's sort of this society of children. And in a way, it sort of flips Lord of the Flies because, you know, there's no adults, but instead of terrible things happening, they all get along just fine, you know. But the characters, even though they're children, the actual characters are animals, and they're sort of hybrid animals. So, you know, like they've got these stuffed animals I brought in with me today, and the main character is fused with a cow and a possum, and there's another character that's like a cheetah and an elephant, and, you know, sort of the heroine of this story is a gazelle mixed with a bird, like with a duck. So, and I think that's why kids are so into it and why, you know, like my son Aiden, who's two, loves the stuffed animals so much is there's sort of been a saturation of characters who are animals, like Winnie the Pooh, Kung Fu Panda. But at the same time, this is kind of different from something like Dr. Seuss, where who knows what those things are, because kids recognize the pieces of a possum or the trunk of an elephant or whatever. You know, Aiden said, oh, I love his trunk. Look at his trunk. But they're strange. You know, they're hybrid animals. So,
and they live in this island. It's, as the story goes, it has not been found by humans. But there are different places. So, I mean, you can see touches of J.R. Tolkien in this mm-hmm. because here's where the swamplands are and here's who lives there. And so there's a map available.
Yeah, definitely. And what I love about the setting of this particular book is it was in a part of the island called Tree Village. And as soon as I read about it, I was like, okay, I'm in. You know, and like you said about Tolkien, it reminded me of Lorien, you know, sort of these enormous trees. You know, I lived in the Bay Area for a while, so it reminded me of the Redwoods. Mm-hmm. And I just love it because there's not a lot of urban influence. You know, there's not a lot of technology. The kids, the animals are really resourceful. You know, they sort of make their own things. And it's basically the middle of a forest.
So how did you connect with the people who created this land to write a story for them?
I really feel like I lucked out. It was a teacher of the year who's the 2007 Illinois Teacher of the Year, and his vision for this was that he'd find writers who were also teachers of the year.
And which you were for Arkansas.
Yeah, for Arkansas. And so the idea is that then, you know, the books are good adventure stories on their own. They stand alone, but he'd also have these teachers go through and create lesson plans that go with them. So if a teacher wanted to do it as a read-aloud with a little guided reading group in class, there's all these lessons that kind of build on the themes or the adventure in the book. So, you know, this the previous book was written by the Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. This is like kind of one out of these 10 books that will be coming out. The third book will be, you know, this Illinois Teacher of the Year, and then I did the second one.
Now, I don't want to give too much away, but what happens in this book is a mean song is written by one animal about another, and it escalates, right? It's called Clubhouse Clash, so things start happening.
Exactly, yeah. And I feel like there were influences from books I read as a kid. Like, I always loved the Butter Battle book, you know, which is about the Cold War, but it's basically this escalation of increasingly giant weapons. And so a similar thing happens here where, you know, you're exactly right. There's a song that is sort of misheard, sort of like if you ever played that game Telephone, mm-hmm. where you start with a normal sentence and it ends up getting so garbled. So a friend overhears that song and thinks it's mean and relays it to this kid in the book who gets really kind of upset and decides that she's after him, and it leads to this escalating clash of the clubhouses. The idea actually came from my third grader's conflicts at recess. I mean, that's what it came out of. And so what I noticed is there was a real gender divide for second and third graders. So with the boys, it was usually very straightforward. You know, Carlos kicked me when we were playing soccer. I got mad, so I punched him in the head. But now we're fine. You know, it's very physical, very violent, and it's over right away.
Right.
For the girls, it was this really elaborate kind of set of miscommunications. So I'd have a student come up a lot of times just in tears and say, Daniela doesn't want to be my friend anymore. And my question was always, you know, did you hear her say that? Well, no, but Maria's cousin heard that when she was at her house last week, then Anna told her that her friend overheard, you know, and so it's
right.
This chain of miscommunication. And a lot of times once she goes up to that girl, it's not what the girl said at all.
I don't mean to get away from the book for a minute, but is that something that happens when you're a teacher? Like you, because those of us who don't have children or aren't in the schools, we think you're teaching reading or math or whatever. But do you hear their problems a lot? Their personal?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, too, is, you know, what you realize pretty quickly is that if you can address those things, what are really going on with the kids, it actually saves you so much time to really teach the academic stuff. So, you know, my wife Karen and I were teaching in New York, and we realized that even though we had all these systems in place, the kids had conflicts that really distracted them. And recess and lunch would just ruin a child. You know, they'd come back angry, and it was just over for the day. So we developed this idea that's actually in the book of a peace talk that's really straightforward, where the kids go off on their own. There's no adults involved, but we teach the process up front. They basically say, you know, when you did this, I felt this way. I felt angry. You know, when you talked about how my drawing looked silly and you laughed, it made me feel embarrassed. You know, next time I want you to just tell me that quietly, not in front of the class. So there's just, you know, here's how I felt. Here's what I want you to change. the other child says it, and then they shake hands if they want, and it's done. And it was amazingly effective, even though it was so simple. And so that's kind of the resolution in here, is that idea of a peace talk.
When you're writing a book like this, I mean, this is aimed for young readers. Do you hope that that sinks in? I mean, as a writer, you never know what is taken away. But is that kind of the hope, that maybe there will be some of that done in real life?
Definitely. And I think that's kind of the vision for these books, is that they don't want them to be preachy. They don't want there to be a lesson. They're not fables, you know, where there's this really heavy-handed moral at the end. But at the same time, the idea is, you know, they're written not just for parents who want to share them with their kids, but teachers who might want to use them in the class. And so for this one, some of the lesson plans that come out of it deal with those themes of conflict, not just between two kids, but between nations. And a lot of the language is the same. A lot of the principles are the same. So if you look in this book, you know, there's the idea of innocent bystanders, for example. When we get into this clash of the clubhouses, most of the people who get hurt are not the ones actually involved in the conflict. They're all the neighbors who end up getting smashed by mistake, sort of collateral damage, you know. And then just the idea of escalation, that it can start with a miscommunication. Pretty soon it leads to kind of a physical conflict, and it gets out of hand really quickly. So, yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot of implications for kids, but also when they look at history and kind of the history of war with people.
How does it work that you're writing scenes and dialogue and attitudes of characters that somebody else has invented? Was there back and forth like, wait a second, this character wouldn't do that or might do it in a different way?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking through just the images that had been created by the artists, and then there's sort of these profiles, you know, of what the characters are like. So one of my favorites is sort of the heroine, Zabetta, and she's a little bit like Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games books. You know, she's very resourceful. She's very fierce. She's a loyal friend, but you really don't want to mess with her. You know, she kind of creates her own weapons, you know, her own tools. And so I read a lot of that sort of background, and then it helped me, too, that there had already been one book written in the series, so I could sort of look at, you know, not only kind of their personality, but everything down to the way they talk and sort of, you know, their demeanor. So in some ways, I think it helped me to have that context. It wasn't sitting down from scratch the way it is with these other novels I'm trying to get published, where I created everything and it took years. There was already a map. There were already characters there.
All right, Justin Mingle, author of Clubhouse Clash. Do you mind reading a bit from this?
Sure.
And what's happening here?
So I'll pick up in the middle, where basically the conflict has gotten out of hand. There's two warring clubhouses. One is these two female characters, Zabetta, who I just mentioned, and sort of her sidekick. The other is Figley, who's this really sweet, kind of emotional male character, and he's got his own sidekick. And so they're kind of escalating the conflict when we come here at the top of these giant trees in Tree Village. Smash. Oh, and one thing I should tell you. These creatures who are hybrids, some of them already existed, but we could also create our own. So one of the creatures I invented in here is called a waspido. So it's basically a combination of a wasp and a mosquito. So something you would not want to mess with. They have the proboscis to sting you on the front. They've also got the stinger on the end. So one of the weapons that the kids end up using in here are these waspido hives. So it's sort of like a hornet's nest, but worse.
Before you go, what dark place in your brain came up with a cross between a wasp and a mosquito?
You know, I have no idea. I was just reading so many of these hybrid creatures in here. I just thought it would be a terrible thing. I love the name. It sort of sounds like torpedo, you know.
And it sounds like something you'd find in the Ozarks.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, every year I see bugs I've never seen before, despite living here since third grade. So here it is. Smash. A waspido hive struck a house just below Figley's hut. Figley's neighbor, a little kid with floppy ears and a beak, ran out onto his porch. He howled in pain as he flapped his big ears at the cloud of waspidos hovering above him. Figley and Waddy ran to load the first arrow into their crossbow. Fire! Waddy yelled. They pulled the trigger, and the huge arrow flew into the air. The arrow missed Zabetta's hut, but it smashed into the next tree over. The gourd at the arrow's tip shattered against a tree, slopping swamp slime into the hammock that belonged to Zabetta's neighbor, an amphibious marsupial. The marsupial hopped out of her hammock and scooped the slime out of her pouch, shaking her fist at the sky. A kind of madness took hold of Figley and Waddy then. They loaded each arrow as fast as they could, breathing hard. Figley's heart pounded in his chest, and the blood beat in his ears like thunder. Crashes, smashes, howls, yowls, whacks, and thwacks cracked the peaceful night. There were some near misses. Figley leapt off the porch just before a rotten stenchelope would have thumped him on the head, and Rumbler ducked an arrow that almost crushed her fuzzy belly. But most of the arrows and ammo missed their targets, creating havoc in Tree Village. Neighbors had fled their homes for the ground below, abandoning their huts as huge arrows flew through their windows and stenchelope splattered their doors. Waddy and Figley loaded their last arrow into the crossbow and then stopped. An eerie silence had fallen. They must be out of ammo for their catapult, Waddy squealed. He rubbed his hands together, grinning a crazy grin. We won the war. Figley looked around at the broken branches and smashed huts. He listened to the wails and sobs from the frightened neighbors gathered below. Just an hour ago, this had been their peaceful neighborhood. "If this is what it feels like to win," he said softly, "I'd hate to lose."
Okay, so we hear that. Should we, you know, it's easy to extrapolate that there's something bigger you're talking about here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that's what I think when you look at conflict resolution with kids, you know, not only does it sort of help them resolve their conflicts, but it helps them think through human conflict, you know, not only the problem, but also the solution, you know, that you get to later. And I think, again, you know, that idea of innocent bystanders. I mean, if you look at something, you know, contemporary like Syria, a lot of times the people that get hurt the most are not the ones who are actually firing the weapons. It's all those innocent people who really just want to go about their lives, you know, the innocent bystanders.
We defined a waspito, a stentalope?
Stentalope is basically like a cantaloupe, except with a horrible, swampy smell.
Is it fun to come up with stuff like this?
It's great. Yeah, it's great. That's what I think kids will like so much about the world. It's just it's so colorful. It's so vivid. It reminds me of a rainforest in terms of just the diversity of plant life and animal life. There's something here called snapping myrtle that's sort of like a crepe myrtle combined with a snapping turtle, where it's a plant sort of like a Venus flytrap, but this beak pops out, you know? So it's just this kind of crazy world. And there's a lot of, you know, great art that's been done by the artists involved. You know, there's all these stuffed animals. They actually have a couple little animated shorts they're coming out with now. So it's just a fun, colorful world.
What do you think is the effect of making it an adult-free world? I mean, we're talking not humans, but animals. But having them being somewhat juvenile, do you think young readers get something from that?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's every kid's fantasy to have a world without adults. I mean, you know, the reality might be harder than they think, but, you know, this other book that I wrote that I'm working on getting published now, the premise is in some ways similar to Harry Potter, that there's this school where you learn these, you know, magical abilities, but the difference is it's a school run by children. And when I ask my students, you know, what would you think about a school run by kids? No adults, no teacher, no principal. You know, their eyes light up and they get really excited. I also talked, you know, I went down to one of the Arkansas Society of Children Book Writers and Illustrators conferences, and they had an agent there, and she said the biggest problem she sees with manuscripts that come to her are that adults solve the problems. And she said, you know, it's fine to have adults in there, like Dumbledore is in Harry Potter, but ultimately it's Harry and Ron and Hermione that are solving the problems.
I had never thought about that, but some of the books that I enjoyed so much as a young reader, the Hardy Boys and things like that, it was the younger people who were eventually solving. They might have aid from adults.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Boxcar Children for the same reason. It's these kids kind of seeing, can they make it on their own, you know, without all the rules of adults.
You're a writer. You're also someone who you preach the value of reading at a very young age. You've seen how reading makes students better, right?
Definitely. Yeah. One of the projects I worked on lately was this home library project called the 1,000 Books Project, where basically I realized my students who are at Jones Elementary in Springdale, mostly lower income, mostly English learners, a lot of them had 3 books at home or 7 books. And I looked at my daughter, who then was 2, who had, you know, these 3 shelves filled. And I just realized it's such an obvious thing. But having those books in your life, like you just talked about with the Hardy Boys, it has a tremendous influence. You know, so we did this project where the kids built up a home library of 40 books, and I just saw a tremendous change, not just as readers in terms of ability, but as people, as human beings.
Someone, I don't know if it was you, termed coined the term book gap, that there are kids who have a lot of books in their lives and some children who don't.
Yeah, and the research I read was pretty staggering. I mean, they talked about, you know, even in middle-class families, it was a lot lower than I would have thought, about 12 books to a kid, and they talked about some inner-city neighborhoods being crazy. I mean, it was like 300 children for one age-appropriate book. And so I think it's something that schools just don't think about. You know, and so that's kind of the, like, when I'm writing it, I just enjoy it. I get into the story. I feel like sometimes the characters do things I didn't intend at some point. You know, you write it and you're like, wow, I didn't see that coming until I was in the middle of writing. But at the same time, when you're done, I mean, that's part of the hope is that these kids will experience these books. You know, I mean, I grew up in Stone County, Arkansas, where there was a library. It wasn't incredible, but my dad would always mail me these books when he had to leave for the work, you know, in other states. And so I'd run down, you know, this gravel road and open it, and there'd be, you know, The Great Brain book or, you know, Children of the Dragon, some fantasy book. And it's just incredibly exciting.
So where can people find this book?
Nightbird Books. Lisa Sharp, who's wonderful and always supports local authors, has, you know, agreed to order some books, and she'll keep it in stock there. You know, by the time this airs, I will have just done a little signing with some other local authors, and she has those sort of local author extravaganzas every once in a while. And there's also a website, mutasia.com. It's just mutasia.com.
So that's how it's pronounced. I had a reader's vocabulary in that, mutasia.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, for the mutation.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, who are your friends that you brought with you?
So I've got three of the characters here. They have these little stuffed animals. Zabetta, you know, who's my probably my favorite.
And she, you made her the heroine of your book.
Exactly, yeah. And she is, you know, part gazelle, part duck, like her duck legs here. Then Figley is sort of the hero of a lot of the books, or sort of the protagonist. He's, you know, part possum and part cow. And then Chadwick is, you know, fairly scientific. He's got this long sort of elephant trunk, but he's more of sort of a cheetah.
I like it. And the other book you mentioned that you're working on, or have you completed it?
Yeah, I've completed it, and right now I'm sending it out to agents and publishers. It's, you know, for kids in the middle grades. It's a little bit older than these. This book is really, you know, for kids to read on their own, maybe first, second, third graders, up to fifth graders who get excited about, you know, the Clash of the Clubhouses. And then as a read aloud for kids as young as my daughter, who's five.
Do you remember a couple of books that when you were very young, some of the first books you read that really got you hooked on reading?
Definitely. I mean, my mom read me The Hobbit when I was really little, and it was too hard for me. And something about that idea of Bilbo Baggins just loving home so much, but also, you know, loving the adventures he had really stuck. I've read that one probably 20 times. Like when I went to West Africa, wow. I read it on the plane. About anytime I take this big trip, you know. And then just, you know, I was always into fantasy books as a kid.
All right. Justin, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Kyle.
Justin Minkle is the author of the new book, Clubhouse Clash, that is part of the Mutasia series for young readers. He is an elementary school teacher in Springdale and was named the Arkansas Teacher of the Year in 2007. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh my God!
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
It looks empty.
No, there's someone living back there.
He's a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus. Resident Evil?
Listen to This American Life Sundays at 10 a.m. on KUAF.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling, yahoo! Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
Glenn Travis Campbell was born in Delight in Pike County, April 22, 1936. He made a name for himself as a solo performer as well as a session player working in a variety of genres. That included recording on sessions for artists as varied as Frank Sinatra, Merle Haggard, The Mamas and the Papas, and Dean Martin. A supremely talented instrumentalist and vocalist, Campbell also recorded and toured with the Beach Boys and logged time as a member of the Champs of Tequila fame. Among his forays into many genres and styles, Glenn Campbell additionally found time to record several sides of holiday-themed music.
Christmas is for children, just for children. Grown-ups say.
Glenn Campbell's first Christmas album came relatively early in his solo career, 1968's That Christmas Feeling, released just weeks before his TV show, The Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour, debuted. The album featured a mix of World War II-era standards like The Christmas Song and I'll Be Home for Christmas, along with more modern fare such as Roger Miller's Old Toy Trains and Willie Nelson's Pretty Paper.
Every Christmas Eve again, we may think we're old, but our hearts can almost believe again.
That Christmas Feeling was a success, topping Billboard's Christmas album chart in 1968, and his Christmas Is for Children single hitting the top 10. The album charted again during the holidays for the next 3 years and went gold.
When daughter starts to greet you with her warmest grin, and Junior's got his room much neater than a pin, and if they fight to hug you each time you walk in, it must be getting close to Christmas.
1971's Christmas with Glenn Campbell followed, but it would be the 1990s before Glenn Campbell went comparatively Christmas crazy.
And all at once, your favorite things are close at hand. And suddenly, Lombardo is their favorite band. It must be getting close to Christmas.
1993 saw release of Glen Campbell's Home for the Holidays, full of well-known titles such as Oh Holy Night and What Child Is This. 2 years later, he recorded Christmas with Glen Campbell, his 55th LP, with songs like Jingle Bell Rock, Frosty the Snowman, and Winter Wonderland.
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is a-coming to town. He's making a list, he's checking it twice. You're gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is a-coming to town.
Following 1995's Christmas with Glen Campbell, Campbell recorded his third holiday album of the 1990s and 56th album overall with 1998's A Glen Campbell Christmas. With no other Campbell albums released in the interim, Campbell had recorded two Christmas albums back-to-back. The release was in a more traditional musical vein than previous, with songs like Away in a Manger and God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen.
With a little tin horn and a little tin drum, a rooty toot toot and a rummy tum tum, Santa Claus is a-coming to town.
Glen Campbell's holiday albums have been repackaged many times, but Campbell's Christmas music was but a small part of his decade-spanning and genre-spanning career. Here in its entirety is Glen Campbell of Pike County with Christmas Is for Children from his first Christmas album in 1968, That Christmas Feeling.
Christmas is for children, just for children. Grown-ups say Santa's down the chimney. That's for children, like the reindeer and the sleigh. That same tale is told every Christmas Eve again. We may think we're old, but our hearts can almost believe again. Christmas is for children, but aren't we all children? Christmas Day. That no one could tempt Papa with. Will someone explain why it's all that Papa will bother with? I guess Christmas is for children. But aren't we all children? Christmas Day.
Pike County native Glenn Campbell with Christmas is for Children from his first Christmas album, That Christmas Feeling, from 1968. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Happy Holidays.
Arkansas Songs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansas Songs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. It's the Christmas season, and many children's wish lists have items like video games, iPads, Legos, or Barbies. Our insect expert joins us this holiday season to offer some ideas for gifts about insects and nature. Dr. Donald Steinkraus's interest in insects began when he was just 5 years old.
I found a Cecropia moth, which is a moth which occurs in Arkansas. It's one of the great big silkworm moths. And I just loved that insect. But my parents always encouraged me in my interest of nature, birds and insects and plants, but particularly insects. And I think one advantage of liking nature and being encouraged in nature is to get you out in the yard, get you out hiking, camping, and looking at things in nature. I think it has great value for children.
For sure.
I think the first gift I would like to see people give their children is the gift of encouraging them in their natural interests. Often when I've done outreach programs for bugs, I'll run into parents who hate the sight of an insect, and they'll have these little like 5-year-olds with them, and they'll sort of try to give that attitude to it, and like, disgusting, you know, like a bug is disgusting. So that's not encouraging children in an interest in nature. So I guess a great gift any parent can give to their child is to not discourage them,
right,
and to encourage them.
That sounds like a good one.
Yeah. In my case, my parents were fantastic. They bought me books, entomology books, which I still have. This is a characteristic of longtime entomologists. They almost always have the books their parents got them when they were a child. And
well, and when we went grasshopper hunting, a book came in very handy in identifying.
That's a great book by this guy, mm-hmm, Caponera, mm-hmm, in Florida. Yeah, I just recently ordered that because I was using a library copy. But you really need those things to encourage the kids' interests. I really think encouragement and certainly not discouragement could really help a child.
What's next? Ant farms?
Well, ant farms are okay. I've never really had an ant farm, but I think, you know, for some kids, an ant farm would be a useful thing. That's a good point, though. There's a lot of things you can do. You can buy butterflies through the mail, painted lady butterflies with a little cup of media or diet for them, and a child or a classroom can follow through the life cycle. They can also get tomato hornworms that way, and oriental silkworms are another good one to raise, and you can buy those over the internet. You could search for silkworms, and people buy those also and raise them for their amphibians and other animals to eat.
Or perhaps planting a butterfly garden, maybe the seeds for a butterfly garden.
Yeah, that's a very good idea.
Because then you get the best, you get beautiful flowers and butterflies also.
Exactly, yeah. Right. That's one of the things I thought would be really important is to encourage a child to have plants which produce nectar and pollen, which, like you say, are beautiful, but also would attract insects. And then they could see these insects during the summertime and observe them, collect them, photograph them. That goes a long ways, which brings up something I think is a big change. Even when I was like 10, I was photographing insects. But when I was 10, photographing insects was extremely difficult. You had to have like a film camera, and you had to have all kinds of extension tubes. And it was really not easy to do a good job. And I'd photograph things, but now with the cell phones and digital cameras, anybody can make an excellent, mm-hmm, collection of insect photos at butterflies. And so I think that's another good gift for a child at Christmas would be a decent digital camera that does good macro close-up work, so the child could be encouraged to develop a collection of butterfly pictures or bee pictures and identify them.
You can get cameras. Some cameras are relatively inexpensive. I mean, there are very expensive cameras out there, but there are some cameras that are inexpensive.
Right, they are. And, someone the other day showed me a digital camera which does video, and it was $50. And
oh, yeah.
That's a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the cell phones now, I have some really expensive cameras, and some of the cell phones take better pictures with their little iPhone than these expensive cameras, and it's simple to carry around. So I think many of the children now do have access to this ability to document what they see and try to develop a collection of these things. And when I was a boy also, we almost always collected with a net. And I do think a net is a good thing for a child to have, an insect net. And you ran around with an insect net when we collected locusts.
I did, yeah.
Grasshoppers. But it gets some exercise, and it's actually quite difficult to catch these things on the wing. And you can then pin them and develop a collection, which is what I did when I was a boy, and that's still a typical thing to do. But I'm going more and more towards thinking not killing a bug and instead photographing the bug, and so you still get a good record of it. And you don't have to actually kill an animal to do that. And it's something that wasn't possible when I was a child,
right. But
it is possible now. So... So I think those are things important. I think books are an important gift, too.
I love to give books.
You do?
Yes. Well, not necessarily about nature and insects, but maybe I'll start. But, yes, I'm usually the aunt that all kids, you know, kind of at birthday parties and Christmas, you know.
Uh-huh.
A lot of kids roll their eyes because, you know, they get books for Christmas. But
that's good. Yeah. I think that's really good. I still love books. I don't think they're all available for Kindles and things. A very good book for Arkansas is Arkansas Butterflies and Moths by Laurie Spencer. She's a local. She works down on Mount Magazine as an interpreter, and she wrote this book.
Oh, yes. I've heard of her and the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a good person. And I think that butterflies and moths are probably the easiest things for kids to get interested in because they are attractive and they're large generally. The next groups which would be good are beetles and flies and wasps and bees and things. But it seems like butterflies and moths are an easy one for people to get interested in. But all these groups would be fun for kids. I really like also this book, A Field Guide to Moths of Eastern North America. Moths are actually much more abundant than butterflies, and putting a light up at night, you can catch a lot of moths and look at them. And they're a great thing for children to raise. If you find a caterpillar, the parents can help them raise that caterpillar and see the life cycle, and they learn a lot about biology by doing that. Having interest in nature can lead to careers. I think sometimes parents don't realize that, too. If a child really likes these things, there are careers as professors and scientists and biologists. Because sometimes read to, like in my case, my parents encouraging me and my teachers encourage me. Here I am, a professor, and I've sort of supported myself my adult life studying insects.
There's something that you loved as a child.
It really did.
Mm-hmm.
I still do, actually.
Yeah.
I still have a great interest in those things.
Yeah.
Other gifts, which a lot depends on your finances. A microscope, a dissecting microscope, is a really useful tool. Entomologists use those all the time because bugs are small. But nowadays with eBay and Craigslist, I think parents could look online and find a good microscope, a good dissecting microscope, for a moderate amount of money, a couple hundred dollars maybe. And a child could really go far with that. And even the family would enjoy it. Just fun to look at flowers and leaves and insects and our fingers, you name it, through a microscope. It's a great joy. And so I think that, depending on a person's budget and the interest of the child, is a good thing to aim for.
Is there something that you would like for Christmas this year?
You're asking the wrong question.
I am?
Yeah. I always have lots of wants.
Yeah?
Yeah. I want a Nord Electro keyboard. So I can play rock and roll keyboard, but
okay.
I'm not going to get it. I've saved up money. I could buy it, but I'm not going to. It's too much.
What about anything
entomological?
Yes.
No, I'm a professional entomologist. I actually have almost everything you could imagine related to bugs that I want.
Okay.
A couple other things I thought about is collecting insects increases a child's powers of observation. You're observing things, and humans were we have grown up with nature as a species, and hunting and gathering and observing and collecting are things we've done forever. And I think kids cannot lose that. They have to have that in their life to be sort of really whole.
Dr. Donald Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. Other suggestions he made are pins and pinning boxes, so children can observe dead insects or hang them on their wall, or purchasing beautiful exotic butterflies, something that his parents bought for him. He says a good place to start is bioquip.com. It is Monday, December 23rd, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and here with me now, Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I told you on Friday, but I'm going to tell you again today.
What's that?
The last Santa hours.
Okay.
Because if you're running around in a frenzy and you still haven't gotten to see Santa and the kids are upset, this is the last minute deal.
I don't have kids, but I haven't seen Santa yet.
I haven't either. So. Well, I tried to take Amanda a week ago. And it was crazy. So, Northwest Arkansas Mall in Fayetteville, 11 to 8, today and tomorrow, which is
Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve. Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers, 10 to 8 today and 8 to 6 tomorrow. Central Mall in Fort Smith is 9 to 9 today and 8 to 6 tomorrow. And if you just want to float away from the whole thing, you could go out and take an Eagle Watch tour that's hosted by Hobbs State Park. There's one at 3 o'clock this afternoon at Rocky Branch Marina. It's $10. Call 789-5000. It would be so peaceful.
It would. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You can hear great jazz right here on KUAF every Friday and Saturday night. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, and my show, Shades of Jazz, can be heard Friday and Saturday nights from 10 till midnight. On Friday night, Daniel Estes steps in at midnight till 1 o'clock with Goodnight Jazz, and on Saturdays, it's Fred Hall taking in the midnight to 1 o'clock hour with Swing Thing. Tune in to KUAF for great jazz.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Pineville, Missouri. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Tomorrow, Christmas Eve, I'll be joined by my co-hosts Kyle Kellums and Antoinette Grajeda. Tune in to hear the special Christmas show that we recorded at the Fayetteville Public Library earlier this month. We have local artists playing Christmas tunes, so we'll hear from the Adams Collins Quartet, Jones and Leah, and Farmers in the Markets playing some holiday favorites, in addition to a couple of special guests. And on Wednesday, Christmas Day, you actually won't hear Ozarks at Large at noon. We have a special NPR holiday program called Tinsel Tales, but we will be back with you on Thursday. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good Monday.